Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Welcome back to All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. We are continuing our celebration of the Outer Critics Circle Awards. Next up, Mary Louise Parker, who received an honor for Outstanding Actress in the Play. For 90 minutes, audiences watching Adam Rapp's play, The Sound Inside, became deeply involved with the dynamic between a creative writing professor at Yale and her student, both of whom are living in that space between alone and lonely. The professor, Bella, wrote a novel which critics likened to Shirley Jackson's The Lottery, and the Washington Post Book World named it one of the best books of the year. But that was 20 years ago. And although we see her scribbling away, she hasn't published a book since. That doesn't matter to a gifted and troubled student of first year, Christopher Dunn, played by Will Hawkman, who is immediately drawn to her. Their lives vibrate off one another as Bella faces a life-threatening event and Christopher faces life. It's part tragedy, part mystery, and it takes a look into human connection. The Sound Inside was written by Pulitzer Prize finalist Adam Rapp. It starred Tony Award-winning actor Mary Louise Parker as Bella, and it was directed by Tony Award winner David Cromer. Mary, David, and Adam joined me in studio this past December, and I began by asking Adam Rapp why he wanted to write a play about two writers.
I think I was at a point where I had written some larger plays, and I thought if I wrote a very small play, it might be more producible. And I had been kind of pinging this idea around in my head about this professor and her student in Crime and Punishment, and how she sort of enlists him to help her through some of the themes in Crime and Punishment. And it just felt like at that point it was a little too narrow, and I wasn't really ready to write it yet. And then I had an experience where I saw these two kids on the train platform at New Haven's Union Station, and one was a white Yale freshman, and the other one was a kind of lower income white kid from the projects, and he was circling the freshman, and I could see something interesting was going to happen. I followed them in their train car all the way back to New York City. And I couldn't figure out what their relationship was going to wind up being, and I was fascinated by it. And then that kind of invaded the idea of the play as well, and I couldn't shake it. So the two ideas collided, and then Andre Bishop came to me and asked me if I would write a play for Lincoln Center, and that was the play that kind of came out. So it was really just an attempt to write something efficient and small that was producible, because I think a lot of playwrights and people in the theater know that. You know, if it's shorter and smaller, it's probably more easily done.
When you say small, what do you mean?
Intimate, like two people, you know, a two-hander, as they say, a couple of sets, minimal costumes, nothing flying in, just to kind of keep it really simple. So it's about ideas and words and actions and stakes.
But playwrights are, I mean, it's you seem sort of reconciled to it, but it's infuriating to watch my writer friends deal with the idea that they have to scale down. They can't just write what they want to write. They have to say, like, well, you know, I've heard people, you know, how many times has the theater said to you, well, we'd like it to be like four characters and one set? You know, like, it's like that would be,
that's the driving force as opposed to the creative part.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. That you would describe the play as something you thought would be producible when it's just this soulful, you know, right. I mean, this outpouring of sort of pain and anguish and loneliness, you know.
You just write everything about multiple personality disorder.
And then
it's
one
like
person
cast
can play.
Fewer actors. Yeah. Yeah.
You're a practical person. Was it always going to be a 90-minute play? Or was that the thing, kind of thing, you just manicured it down and made it concentrated?
I really didn't know how long it was. I know that we probably cut, I would say, 15% of what was originally there and the early work that Mary Louise and David and I did on the play. And that's all part of the process. And I think I've always believed in my work, because a lot of my work deals with anxiety and tension and, like, people on stage doing terrible things to each other. I feel like that's good for about 100 minutes. That's just a law that I passed for myself. But I think this just got lucky at the 90-minute level. That's where it felt right.
So, Mary Louise, you write as well as being an actor. Yeah. So what was it about this play, The Sound Inside, that you really liked as a playwright or as a writer? And then what appealed to you as an actor?
I just responded to the prose. The writing of it was so beautiful. And I didn't honestly think I was the right actor for it initially. And tried to cast other people.
I love the director. She's like, what are you talking about?
Mandy Greenfield was so sweet, and I was walking my dog, and she was like, I've been dying to send you this play, and blah, blah, and I read it, and I thought it was so beautiful, and I just thought of all these other people who could probably do it better. But then I read it, and sometimes you don't know, even if you respond to it, you don't know when you go to read it aloud if it will happen, or it might not fall out of your mouth in any particular way that feels right. But I went to do a reading of it, and Adam was there, and it just seemed to kind of happen in a way that really surprised me. I still wasn't certain that anyone would want to watch it. Like, I knew that I would want to hear it, and I think I don't have as much faith in, you know, I don't know. I feel like it's such a literary piece, and it requires such concentration on the part of the audience. And I have to say, the audiences have been so wonderful. Yesterday, there was an audience member literally actually made me cry afterwards. He was just so sitting in the front row, and I normally don't even see people in the front row, but people are so engaged with this play. And at the end, I have to look right at them, and I couldn't help but see this person and see how affected they are. So I really sort of underestimated people's level of how people could really sort of enlist their powers of concentration for that long. And I think so much of that is how beautifully written it is, and how David just kind of magically and masterfully created this world. I don't even know where it came from in him, but he created a world that really sucks people. I guess that's why they say you're the best. There's something out front of the theater that says you're the best, so I think that's probably why. Because he's the best, right?
Truth and advertising.
It's me out front of the theater saying I'm the best. Sometimes I just stand out there and say, wow, the direction. You guys should go
inside. But it is. It's things that you wouldn't have really envisioned. And it brings this like writing that's so rich and beautiful that is sometimes difficult to get. It's sometimes difficult to enact that, the words that are that beautiful and that rich and make them move on stage, make them do things with them, you know? Sometimes things that are purely colloquial, it's easier to give them velocity. Mm-hmm. And with his writing, it's a combination of the two of them, you know, and my kind of hypervigilance about wanting things to be active. I think that seems like people usually don't fall asleep.
you couldn't fall asleep in this play. You really couldn't. David, what is having only two characters, what opportunities does that provide you as a director?
Oh, that's a really interesting question. There is no means of escape for either of the characters, and they have to hash it out. It presents a challenge, which is there's a marvelous director from Chicago named Dennis Zajac who once said after a reading, God, these two character plays are relentless. It's like, you again. And so, like, I always think of that every time I'm doing a new character. I'm like, okay, we got to keep the you again factor down, you know. But it forces people to, it creates an infinitely smaller world. I was just talking about this with someone earlier about how, like, you know, you can be in the city and then everything's noisy and chaos, and there's little by little you start to talk to one person, then everything else goes away, and then it's only the words, and it's only you can forget everything else. So it really zooms the world down. And there's no escape for any of those. One of them has to leave, you know. And so it's you can't. There's you have to make a really articulated spine all the way through it. So it and that serves the evening. That hopefully keeps the audience awake. So that's there is less places to hide.
Fewer places to hide. So there's interesting. There's a lot of projection in theater in the past couple of years, and there's a little bit in this,
a very little bit.
And I'm curious about your decision making process when you do have this intimate play, these two people having this relationship, trying to figure out their lives, but it really helps us, the audience, know sort of the severity at least in one point. So what went your decision process about, like, okay, this is a place I can use this modern tech, so it won't be intrusive?
Right. Well, aside from the fact that it is still a relatively new tool in the toolbox for people, and I've used it to I'm interested in it. I use it sometimes, and I've used it to greater or lesser degrees. I would say that the first and foremost, I had this thing that was like prose in this play that was intentionally a playwright wrote a piece that was intentionally prose-like, because it was about prose and because it was about the making of prose, mm-hmm. or the idea of prose. So it was that. So I had this to start with. So the descriptions, the images are in the text, so that they first don't need to be manifested as much by me. That was the first thing I realized, that it was going to lead with the words. Then you have Mary Louise playing it. And if I may gush back, and I don't say this in an articulate way, but as Adam and I have said many times, no one uses language like her, as no one exploits language like her, without any kind of bombast to just like say a throwaway of three or four words and just have all of these images and associations just explode out from them for the audience, for us, for mm-hmm. the listener. You know everything about the way this person feels, thinks, and all the thoughts they've had about something. So you have that. So first of all, I got to stay out of the way of those two things: the words of the play and the performance of the actor I have. So I know that. Also, the thing about prose is prose. The reader, when you're reading prose, fills in all the visuals, and that's actually literally a line in the play, but also something we all understand. So, and it was going to be a spare production, mostly, you know, sort of there's this sort of dark void at the beginning and things emerge out of darkness. I did feel like there was, in the same way that an actor does that, in the same way that a writer does this, we're going to ask for a great deal of attention from the audience, but we're going to reward them occasionally with, I just wanted to goose the audience's imagination once in a while they were filling in blanks with something they could perceive of. The ones I think you were thinking of, the
medical stuff.
The medical stuff. I think of the tree. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It's only I care about the tree.
I love the tree.
But I love the tree too. I'll try to say this simply. I wanted to let it be words and let it be her, and then occasionally, just have a little, just push the audience, just nudge the boat in the water a little bit. So that was the idea there, and then once in a while to smack, you know. But it's just not to be excessive. It's to use negative space was the idea.
So I'm curious about the plot point, where you have this 50-something woman, very smart. She's in her office. This young man, Christopher, comes in. They have this sort of interesting engagement. And he does something that's just really foul, I think. As a woman, I found it really foul. He spits on her floor.
And spits well.
Yes.
Yet Bella's still interested in him. I'm at the two of you. Why would she still be interested in somebody who comes in and spits on her floor?
Well, I think if she's constantly teaching Crime and Punishment and she's fascinated by the notion of the anti-hero, he's coming in with that knowledge, and I think he's adopting some of that performance aspect. You know, I think he's coming in trying to impress her, trying to show her that he's paying attention and that he's becoming his own anti-hero in his own life. So I think both of those things led me to write that moment. I don't even know if Raskolnikov in Crime and Punishment actually spits. I'm sure he does, but
he says it. He uses it as conjecture, and yeah. I think the way he says, he says something irrefutable to me. He says, "Isn't that what he would do?" Mm-hmm. You know, and it's so apt, and it is like so many other things that he says. It's brilliant writing. I can see him writing as he speaks, and that's what engages her with him. And I think when he says that, it's so apt, it's so bright, it's so unexpected. And it's truthful that he has a point. Hmm. And I can't really deny that. It doesn't mean I'm not angry. It doesn't mean I'm not like, why did you do that? But he has a point. And I think she's a woman who can take a point.
Though both those characters don't have conventional responses to things. And they don't. She might be, as you said, you know, she might be like angry or frustrated with it. But it's not she can handle bad behavior. You know what I mean? And that she does not have sort of conventional outrage about things. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think yeah. also if he hadn't said what he said after it, it might have been a different moment.
Right. All right.
And, yeah. you know, she did say something a bit dismissive and snide, you know, to him. Not that it warranted, you know, his reaction, but I think what he said was, I think it's what he said was so bright that she couldn't really argue with it.
Yeah, one of the things, too, that was interesting to me is, like, they actually talk about, she talks about hard actions and, like, how unexplained hard actions are. She sort of praises him at the end for what she recognizes as a hard action in his novella. I don't want to give anything away, but there's a moment that happens with the Statue of Liberty paperweight. And I think that they both value that. And
there are papers blowing around, and they take the paperweight and they put it on top of them.
Yeah, it's about papers. Yeah. But I think that was interesting to me, and it was interesting to me that they both appreciated unexplained hard actions. So somebody, I can't remember who it was, when I was studying playwriting early in my, when I was kind of trying to teach myself, I was talking about Harold Pinter and why I liked The Birthday Party, why I liked Homecoming so much. I couldn't explain it, and somebody who was much smarter than me explained it back to me that Harold Pinter never actually discusses psychology in his plays. He just discusses hard actions, and that people, we live our lives impulsively doing things. We live our lives making bad decisions and enacting bad behavior occasionally, and that's the most interesting behavior. So I've always tried to remember that, that it's not about a psychological profile as much as it is about an unexplained hard action that kind of can turn a play.
Right. Bella also does call him out for spitting on her floor the next day, and they have a fairly extensive negotiation on how on how this this hard action will be amended, how he can make amends.
Let's talk about Will.
Oh yeah,
Hawkman, who plays Christopher. What was it like the first time you worked with him, Mary Louise, and how did you two work together and evolve that relationship?
Well, we worked together in his audition because I wanted to be there for the auditions, and I think it's hard to read sometimes with a reader. Sometimes it's easier to read with an actor. And I really enjoyed working with him then, and I really enjoyed, what I really enjoyed about him was his willingness to not be able to answer a question, to say, no, I don't know what you mean, or to say, can you explain that? And I just really respect that so much. And, you know, it's evolved over time because it's a living thing. And because for me, there's no point in doing it if it doesn't grow and change and live each night. For, you know, theater's expensive. And I don't want to do last night's show for the people who paid to come tonight. And he hasn't really done a long run of a play before. He's only really done, I think, one or two runs of a play, and I've been doing it for like 35 years. So we're kind of a great combination in that way. And we rode to Brooklyn last night and watched, I showed him a video and we talked about it. And I said something and he said, Wait a second. He pulled up this file on his phone. He's been taking notes, you know, of every single thing that he's said that has struck him in a deep way since we started in Williamstown. And I said something last night. He was, say that again. And I was like, okay, when the evolution becomes a devolution. And he was like writing it down. He has like reams. So, and he also, he's young and sweet and he's irreverent. And I'm old and sour and irreverent, and we have a good time together, you know, and we have a warm-up that we do together that's a secret that we do before we go on, and we just have a bond, and it's I can't imagine what it would be like without that, you know. And there's a negotiation with any actor that you're doing a play with for a very, very long time. It's mm-hmm. a challenge. And it's more of a challenge of yourself, because what your reaction sometimes of what people are doing on stage is often about you and about what is lacking in you, or where you are not reaching, or where you are not meeting someone. Not always, but oftentimes. And so it can be a I mean, this like a, it's so much. It's really a metaphor for everything. Doing a play, I think it's a metaphor for every possible thing, and it's something that I kind of live my life by. And I feel like when I'm doing a play, when I go to places, and when I walk out there, it's when I'm most, with the exception of when I'm with my children, it's when I most understand who I am on the planet.
Before I let you go, for people who go see the play, I'm going to ask each of you for one thing that you would love for them to pay attention to, one small detail, one moment.
That our loneliness or our alone time is valuable and is, that our loneliness can be valuable.
For me, it was something that we discovered in tech. There's a wagon or a piece of scenery that moves from downstage to upstage, so it recedes from the audience. And Mary Louise and Will are on this in this little kitchen scene, and they're in silhouette. And it was just this kind of thing that David and the set designer and a bunch of us really loved. And it's just, I think, like one of the most, I just think it's a beautiful piece of staging, and it's just so simple, and it feels like she's receding away from us, and we make this assumption about the moment as an audience, and then the play changes again, and I think it's the most brilliant thing they do in the play in terms of staging and staying ahead of the audience.
The Sound Inside is currently at Studio 54. Mary Louise Parker, David Cromer, and Adam Rapp, thanks so much for coming to the studio.
Thank you.
Thank you.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.